Well, welcome to the Saturday night speaker meeting of the Stephenville Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Stephen Williams, and I am an alcoholic. My family. Will you please join me in a moment of silence followed by a serenity prayer? And can we please remember Bob's family and his loved ones and us also this time? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. This is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we are glad that you're all here, especially the newcomers. In keeping with our singleness of purpose and our third tradition, which states the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking, we ask all that who participate confine their discussions as they relate to alcoholism. Or this is a closed meeting. I believe this is an open. Thank you. Preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, and neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. In accordance with group conscience, we ask that if you have a cell phone, you please place it on vibrate or turn it off so as not to disrupt this meeting. There's no children. Also, we're not sharing because we have a speaker, and I know David's long-winded, and he'll take up a whole hour. I have asked friends to read how it works, the 12 traditions, the promises. I've asked Lenny to hand out the chips.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you.
My name's LaCrecia. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. And this is how it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go, absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. Without help, it is too much for us, but there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took which are suggested in the program of recovery. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order. I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could have placed you responsible.
One problem I'm an alcoholic is the four traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, loving God as He may express Himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants, they do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supported, tiny outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards and committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Thanks, Tom.
I'm Judy and I'm an alcoholic. The promises. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them.
Thank you, Judy.
Hi everybody, my name is Lynn. I'm an alcoholic. People who work on the chip systems recognize different lengths of sobriety. And we have a silver chip for the newcomer or anybody that's been out experimenting wanting to reestablish a desire date. And the chip for 1 month of continuous sobriety. Two? Three? Six? Nine? Okay, we'll celebrate birthdays at the end of the month. I guess that's next Saturday.
Thanks, man.
Thanks, man.
Thanks, man. Do we have any visitors that wish to be recognized at this time? Okay. Please remember that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, where we are now and where we are going. Please respect this and treat in confidence who and what you see here. It's an honor standing before y'all tonight and to chair this meeting. I spoke to Crystal several weeks ago, and she said the group was having a little bit difficulty in getting people to chair on Saturday nights and to bring in speakers. And I asked if I could do it, and she said, "Well, sure, we'd be appreciative if you would." So Make a long story short, I took an employment position in Fort Worth, which cut down on some of the service work I was doing at my home group, and I'm trying to fill that void. And one of the ways that I thought I might be able to fill that void is to help this group out in trying to do some service work. And so if y'all will have me to, I'd like to sign up once a month or whatever and try to bring somebody new in to speak. And that's also to help get my home group in Meridian involved too. So tonight's speaker is David A. I'll let him introduce himself as how he wants to. David is from the Meridian group, my home group. It's kind of unusual. I really have two home groups. I've got Meridian home group, and then I've got Stephenville as well, because this feels just as much as a home group as a Meridian group does. My very first meeting that I went to after I got out of treatment was here in Stephenville. The next meeting I went to was in Meridian, where I live. And there for the first few months, I was making more meetings in Stephenville than I was in Meridian. I don't make it over here quite as often as I used to, but I still try to come every chance that I get. Tonight, David is going to speak to y'all. He's going to tell his story, and David is from the Meridian group. And David is one of my very dear friends. If I need something, if I need help, I call David. And usually that's on a Saturday night or Sunday night when I'm driving somewhere, going to a meeting and don't know where I'm going. And I pick up the phone and I call David and say, "Hey, David, I'm headed to Granbury. Where's the meeting at?" Or, "David, I'm headed to Waco. Turning Point. Yeah. Where do they meet on Sunday nights?" Well, they don't meet on Sunday nights. But anyway, "David, I think I'm going to go to Burleson tonight. Where's the meeting in Burleson?" And David's been more than helpful in that. And I have a lot of respect for David. He and I happen to have the same sponsor, and that's just great because we love to rag on our sponsor every chance we get. But without any further ado, please welcome David.
Thank you, Stephen. I'm David Anderson, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date's June 18th, 1992, and there are a ton of people in my life grateful for that, me especially. Stephen and I rag on our sponsor a lot, but Gary deserves it, so it's okay. Gary has spoken here. As a matter of fact, he spoke here last summer. He's a good man. He's helped a lot. I don't like doing this, to be real honest with you. It's not one of my favorite things in AA, and there's not much that I don't like doing in AA. I get very nervous. I can tell you right now, I don't have a clue what I'm going to say. I went outside right before the meeting and asked God to put the words in my mouth that He wanted y'all to hear, so if you hear something you don't like, it's His fault, not me. I stole that from an old timer, but it fit. I don't want to spend too much time in my drunk log, but I guess I have to qualify a little bit. I can tell you that from my very first drink at about age 12, I drank to get drunk. And every time I drank to get drunk. People would ask me, "Let's go get a beer after work." And I'd say, "Why? Why would I want to get a beer?" I always wanted to get drunk. People that can order a glass of wine at dinner and drink half of it and then just leave it, I want to slap them. Because I sit there and watch the alcohol evaporating out of that glass, and you're just wasting it. My first drink, we were living in Dallas and coming down to Lake Whitney on the weekends. Parents had a lake house and met some kids my age. And we'd come down Friday night, and I'd jump on my little mini bike and ride down to their house. And we discovered his dad had a wine cellar. Well, let's check this out. So we went down, and there's just hundreds of bottles of wine down there. Well, he won't miss a bottle or two. So we'd grab a bottle or two, and we'd go chunk it in the lake and go swimming and let it get kind of halfway cool. And drink it till we puke, you know. And most of them didn't like it. I couldn't wait to do it again. Every summer, every Friday night, first thing I'd do, as soon as we got the car unpacked, I'd jump on my little mini bike, ride down to their house, and we'd grab a couple of bottles. And towards the end of the summer, and I went down there one Friday night, and there was a sheriff's car out in front of their house. I wasn't stopping, you know. I went on down to the park and waited till Bobby and Billy and them showed up, and they finally showed up. And Bobby said, "My old man did an inventory down in his wine cellar." And he said, "There's a bunch of wine missing." I go, "Well, I know. We took it." He goes, "Did you know some of that stuff's worth $500 a bottle?" I said, "No." But, you know, so that put a stop to that. Funny thing is, I've told that story several times from the podium until it dawned on me I owed that man an amends. You know, and I talked to my sponsor and explained the deal, and he told me what it is I needed to talk to him about, and I called this man up and I said, "Can we go get some coffee?" And met at the Dairy Queen one day, and I said, "I got something I need to tell you." And I laid the whole story out to him, and I said, "Whatever I need to do to make that right, it may take a long time, but I want to make that right." And he just started belly laughing. Time he stopped, he looked at me and he said, "We knew y'all were the ones taking it. I got Sheriff Baxter out there just to put a scare into y'all so you'd leave it alone." I said, "Well, it worked." The house next to us, there was a kid 2 or 3 years older than me. They were coming down on the weekends, and this guy was a chemistry genius. So we started brewing 180 fruit booze in the garage, and his dad thought it was a chemistry experiment. Oddly enough, drinking wasn't my deal once I discovered some other substances, and you know, that's a big part of my story, but trust me, everything I ever did, I did alcoholically. It wasn't until Ronald Reagan took office that my alcoholism really started up. And I used to blame the former president. He started his war on drugs. And I don't know about Stephenville, I don't know about Dallas or Austin or anything else, but in Bosque County, it got hard to find pot. And what used to be a 30-minute cruise in the car before you found somebody sometimes was taking a day or 2 days or 3 days. And we kind of rediscovered the beer store. And you know, that would kind of tide us over until we found something. And it just got easier and easier and easier to go to the beer store. You know? When I got here, I was able to put the drugs down and just stop. But I couldn't do that with alcohol. It took me almost a year and a half to get this deal. You know, step one talks about our life being unmanageable. I came to AA in 1991. My wife went to the bank one day to put her check in the bank, and they said, "You know, that takes care of some of the overdraft. What about the rest of it?" She didn't know what they were talking about. She shouldn't be overdrawn. She'd taken my name off the bank account a long time before that. But she'd send me to the grocery store with a signed check to go get some eggs and some bread and stuff. And, you know, she'd say, "How much do you write a check for?" $10. Well, I wrote it for 40. You know, and the rest of that went to the beer store. And I had her account several hundred dollars overdrawn. Well, she came down to where I was working, and I said, "You know, the bank screwed up. Those people don't know what the hell they're doing. They're, you know, a bunch of idiots up there. I'm really busy right now, but if you'll come back in a few hours, we'll go up there and straighten them out." Try to buy a little time. Trying to come up with a really good lie that she fall for. She came back later that afternoon, and I hadn't been able to come up with anything. And words to the effect of, "The bank is probably right. I think I've got a drinking problem," came out of my mouth. That was the only lie I could think of. And I did not believe that. I don't know where those words came from. I didn't at the time. I know now that God put those words in my mouth. She don't think she said a word. She just drove off. What I found out was that she went and talked to her pastor about what was going on. And he said, you know, I know a preacher in town that's in this deal called Alcoholics Anonymous. Maybe this guy can help. So her pastor called this guy, and he was out of the office for the weekend, but had left a number for a guy in Laguna Park. So our pastor called him. The old guy says, well, you know, there's a guy in Valley Mills that's about his age. Let me call him and see if it's okay to give y'all his number. So the guy in Laguna Park called the guy in Valley Mills, who said, sure, give him his number. And the Laguna Park guy calls pastor back, who calls Tammy back, and I get this phone number, call this guy. He's in AA. And I knew nothing about AA. I'd never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous, didn't know what it did, didn't know what it was. But with the story on how she had to get that phone number, FBI, CIA, AA, it was all the same to me. It scared the crap out of me, and I was already scared to death. So I finally got up the courage to call, and the guy wouldn't tell me nothing on the phone. And what do y'all do? Oh, we have meetings. What are you doing in the meetings? Oh, just different stuff. And the only thing he would tell me was there was a meeting Monday night, and if I wanted to go, he'd come by and pick me up. And he said, oh, by the way, there's a meeting for your wife, too, an Al-Anon meeting. About 7:15 Monday night, knock on the door, open up the door, and here's a guy I went to high school with. Hadn't seen each other in 20 years. We hated each other in high school. We could not stand each other's guts. He was a goat roper, and I was a long-haired, dope-smoking hippie from Dallas. You know, my hair wasn't much longer than it is now, but back in Meridian, back in the 70s, we looked at each other and almost in stereo just said, I figured you'd be dead by now. And by all rights, we both should have. A guy named Cole Word, Cole Douglas, excuse me, Cole. He won't care.
He don't care.
Took me to my first meeting. And I can tell you basically a couple of things about my first meeting in AA. One, I remember meeting an old-timer named Josh Hall that was having the most fun of anybody I'd seen in a long time. He was laughing and hooting and hollering and hugging all the ladies and just had this huge smile on his face and big gleams in his eye. And I met another old-timer named Bill Adair. Both of them are gone now. Bill gave me my first big book. I told him, I don't have the money to pay you right now. He said, don't worry about it. So the only way you can pay me back is to give them away. I'm still giving them away, and I'm still paying him back. The other thing I remember was I sat in the back of the room right next to the door that went into the Al-Anon room. And about every 5 minutes, I'd hear them burst out in laughter in that room. And I sat in that AA meeting wondering what she was telling them about me. Because I knew they were in there talking about me. Yeah. I'm the guy that's watching the football game, and when they show the huddle right before the play begins, they're talking about me. I know they are. You know. I took that big book home, and when she went to bed, I pulled my bottle of rum out from under the couch and sat there and drank and read the big book. I am a real alcoholic. There's no doubt. Everything I read in there, I knew was me. I just knew it. But for the next 15 months, I kept trying to do this deal my way. I wanted to take a few of those steps. Some of them applied to me. 4 and 5, I really hadn't hurt anybody. That's not that big a deal. And once I quit drinking, everything would be okay. And making amends, and that's, you know. Of course, that kept getting me drunk, you know, and I'm the guy that was in a men's step meeting where you show up once a week and the whole group takes the steps together, and I tried to do that still drinking. No work. Didn't work for me. In fact, it kind of worked backwards. I've been in and out of the doors for about a year, and I picked up a two-month chip I'm not positive. It might have been a 1 month. But one of them old farts, he says, I want to talk to you after the meeting. And before I knew it, everybody was gone. It was just me and Bill. He says, sit down. Yes, sir. He said, when did you take your last drink? I said, well, Bill, you saw me pick up a chip tonight. He said, that's why I'm asking you. When did you take your last drink? And he was one of those guys you just really couldn't lie to because he already knew. And I just went, yesterday. He goes, why'd you pick up a chip? I said, just wanted one. I don't know. Don't have a clue. He said, I'm going to tell you something. And he said, this ain't really in the big book. And he says, if you tell anybody else I told you this, I'll tell them you're lying. And he said, I'm 18 years sober. Who do you think they're going to believe? He said, but you need to get the hell in this deal or get the hell out. Then he told me he loved me, gave me a hug, and walked out and left me sitting there. So I got out. And my drinking escalated horribly. I was already facing felony theft charges, been fired from work, had embezzled, stolen a bunch of money, and things just weren't looking real good. My wife had moved out, took the kids with her, and I had socked in enough booze for probably about a week. I had drunk until I just couldn't stay awake, pass out, get up, get on the phone, call her, harass her, try to beg her to come back, scream at her, holler at her till she'd have to unplug the phone. I'd get drunk again until I passed out, wake up, pick up the phone, start it all over again. Finally talked her into coming to the house to talk. So one more time I could tell her, I'm through drinking. I'm not going to drink anymore. It was another lie. I had no real intention of stopping drinking. I just needed to get her and the kids back in the house. So after 4 or 5 days of solid drinking, my little mind got to clicking, and I thought, I need to do something dramatic to show her I'm serious. What could I do? And then it hit me. So I went and got a 6-foot step ladder and a bed sheet. I went out in the front yard, and I found a limb coming off a tree, probably about 8 feet off the ground, and I tied one end of the bed sheet to the limb and made this makeshift noose with the other end. And when she pulled up in the front yard, I'm standing on this stepladder with this noose around my neck. Now, I got a long enough sheet to make sure that if I accidentally fell off that ladder, I had enough slack where I could lay down on the ground. I wasn't. But she had enough time in the Al-Anon program. She came with somebody. She brought her brother. And she sent her brother out to me. So while I'm screaming and railing at him about how screwed up his life is, she's inside calling the cops. Within a couple of minutes, there's city police cars, sheriff's cars, highway patrol cars, everybody in our front yard in Clifton, Texas. And they gave me a shackled escort to DePaul down in Waco. I had no intention of staying in DePaul. I knew they could only hold me so long and they were going to have to let me go. And so I was just biding my time. We were in the psych ward. And they wouldn't let you smoke in your room, but you could smoke in kind of a commons area out in the middle. And about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, I woke up and I needed a cigarette. I walk out there and I sit down, and there was a guy that had been standing against the wall every time I went out there those 2 days with his ear against the wall, just standing there. And he saw me and he goes, psst, buddy, come over here. And I kind of looked over at the nurse and she shrugged her shoulders, and I went over there and I said, what? He said, listen to this and tell me what you hear. So I stuck my ear up against the wall and I listened. I said, man, I don't hear a damn thing. He said, it's been like that for 2 weeks. I put my cigarette out and I went back to my room and I closed the door. I didn't used to tell that story, but it's gotten a little funnier over the years. The next day, time was running out for them to keep me, and the counselor sat me down in this little room, and he was trying to get me to sign myself in, and he was doing his darndest, and he had all kinds of good reasons, you know, and I was just nodding my head. And after about 10 minutes, I finally asked him, I said, how long did you go to school to get your degree? And he goes, well, normal 4 years for associates, and I had master's and bachelor's, and you know, 8, 9 years, whatever it was, you know. And I go, that's a damn shame. He said, why? I said, all that schooling, and there ain't a damn thing you can do to keep me in here, is there? And he exploded. He cussed me up one wall and down the other and stormed out of that little room. And I was stunned. This counselor, he ain't supposed to be talking to me this way. Don't you know who I am? And I'm sitting there looking at that form on the table and thought, maybe I do need to be in here. Signed that little piece of paper and went out and gave it to the nurse. And I thought for a long time that maybe that was just one of his little games to get me to sign. And I said, run into him about 6 months later. I was at a meeting at DePaul. And I don't remember the guy's name, but I said, I owe you an amend for the way I acted. And he goes, I've been wanting to run into you because I owe you an amend. He said, I've never, ever reacted that way before, and I don't know why I did to you. And he said, I regret my actions. I go, well, it was me. went through to Paul. A couple of weeks inpatient, a couple of weeks outpatient. Things were starting to get a little better. My wife had come back to the house with the kids. Still a lot of tension. A lot of the havoc I had wrecked over the past couple of months was still popping up. And looking for a job, I got a job lined up at a local newspaper. Not my field of professionalism. But they offered me a little part-time 15-hour-a-week job. And it was just a place to start. The day before I was supposed to start, I was in Clifton running an errand. And I had a blackout, sober. I had not had anything to drink in probably 6 to 7 weeks, maybe longer. And I came out of a blackout coming back from the liquor store with a little bottle of rum, Dr. Pepper in a big glass, half of it Dr. Pepper, half of it rum, and half of that drink already gone. When I came out of that blackout, the portion in the big book that says we have to make that deep down admission to ourselves that we're an alcoholic, it finally made sense to me. Because I've been going to meetings and I've been saying, yeah, I'm David and I'm an alcoholic. And y'all all knew it. Every one of them in every room knew it, except for me. I can take you to the spot on FM 219 right outside of Clifton where I made that deep down admission to myself. I'm an alcoholic, and I've got two choices. I can keep drinking and die, or I can do what the people were trying to tell me to do in this program. So I did what every good alcoholic did. I finished the bottle. I'm already half drunk. Might as well finish it. Went to a meeting that night half drunk. Picked up a desire chip. And started over the next day. And this time it was different. I'd probably picked up 30 or 40 desire chips in the 15 months preceding that episode. But that blackout convinced me that y'all knew what y'all were talking about. And that I was an alcoholic. And I will always be an alcoholic. So I got a new sponsor, and I'd had 4 or 5 to that point. And the kind where, will you be my sponsor? Yeah, here's my phone number, and you never call them. The only time I ever called a sponsor before I got sober, I called old Josh up one night, and I said, Josh, I'm going to get drunk tonight. He says, come out to the house. No. You people just keep saying, call before you get drunk. And I thought, for once, I'm going to do what y'all tell me to do. I'm calling. I'm getting drunk. He goes, no, you need to come out here to the house. I said, Josh, I don't want to hear any of your AA bullshit. I'm just telling you I'm going to get drunk. He says, no. He says, you come out to the house. We'll get in my pickup. I'll drive you over to Laguna Park. I'll buy your bottle for you. I'll drive you around until you get so snot-slinging drunk you can't see, and I'll take you back to Clifton and pour you in your driveway, and I'll come home. I said, what in the hell are you talking about? He said, I don't care if you get drunk or not. He said, I just don't want you out there driving around killing somebody I care about. And I had a few choice words for him and slammed the phone down. Called him the next morning and I said, I just want you to know I stayed sober last night just to spite you. And you can guess the kind of laugh that came from the phone, you know. And, oh, I knew you would, click. But this time it was different. There was a guy I had met at the hall at the meetings that had talked about being in the lumber business, and that was, I was in lumber and hardware most of my life, and saw him at a meeting a few days later and asked him to be my sponsor, and he said yeah. He said, but there's some things you're going to have to do. And I was used to the, you got to read this page, you got to read this page, you got to do this daily devotion, you got blah 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 blah, you know. So I got my pencil and paper out. Okay, what do you want? He says, no, he says, you don't need that. He says, what I want you to promise me right now is just take hold of my hand and hang on. And don't let go. He said, because I know the path that you need to walk. And he said, I'll get you there. But if you let go, I might lose you. And we don't want to lose anybody in this program. So just promise me you'll hang on. It's one of the most powerful things anybody had ever said to me in my life. Yeah. Now, of course, there were a lot of things I had to do after that, you know, and one of them was working the steps. And I'm one of those guys, you don't hear many of them, but I was so beat down when I took my last desire chip that I pressured my sponsor into getting those steps done, not the other way around. I didn't want to wait around. I wanted to get this stuff out of the way. You know, and he was a big believer in doing the steps just like it says in the big book. You know, and I am too. I believe there's a lot of work to all the steps. I have to live them today. I have to live the steps, live the traditions, but there was a lot of work involved, and there's still a lot of work involved. You know, step one is admitting we're powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable. Well, it's pretty obvious my life was pretty damn unmanageable. Powerless over alcohol took me a little while to understand that. You know, it's powerless when it's inside me. Absolutely. And still true today. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I didn't like that word, sanity. Because if he's going to restore me to sanity, that means I had to be insane. And I ain't never been in a rubber room. I ain't never had a straight jacket on. You know, I never thought I was Napoleon. Cracked a dictionary open, which is something they made me do all along too. They told me, when you're reading a big book, keep a dictionary beside you. You're going to come across some words you may not know. He said, look them up. He said, then you're going to come across the words you're absolutely sure you know what they mean. Look them up, because you're going to be wrong. So I looked up insanity, and it said a very foolish thought or belief. And I went, holy crap, I've been insane my whole life. Because almost every damn thought or belief I had, as far back as I could look, was foolish. Absolutely. Made a big difference in being able to take step two. Step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. I'll be honest with you, I thought I was a pretty damn smart person when I got here, and I found out how dumb I really am. I knew all the big words, I didn't know the little words. You know, I had to ask Max, you know, what my will in my life, what does that mean? He said, well, look at it this way, your will is your thoughts and your life is your actions. And he said, those are the only two things you're responsible for anyway. Those are the only two things you have any control over, is what you think and what you do. And he said, you better turn the care of those things over to God right now. You know, he told me that, and I hear it a lot, oh, I've turned my, you know, will and life over to God. Well, it's not what Step says. He turned it over to the care of God. God gave us our will and our life. He didn't want them back. He just wants to be in control. And that's what I strive for today, is letting God control my thoughts, my actions, my life. And when I do that, things work out pretty well. Maybe not exactly like I want them, but usually a hell of a lot better than what I may have planned. Step 4, make a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. The only thing I knew about inventory was when I worked at the lumber yard, they told me, if that bin looks like it had 20 pounds of nails in it, mark it down as 50. That bundle of 2x4s has 20 or 30 in it, that's a full bundle, that's 144. Every inventory I had ever done was dishonest. How am I supposed to do an honest inventory? I don't even know what the hell that is. Well, that's what your sponsor's for. Sponsor walks you through this. Shows you how to set up the columns as you're writing. And, you know, when I was still drinking and doing that men's step team, when we came to step 4, and I had to turn my list in, Bill Adair asked me one night, he said, how many names you got? I said, 184. He said, you got 184 names on your grudge list? I go, yeah. He goes, you haven't even started, have you? I go, I'll go out and get the list right now. Well, you know, I thought about a guy that screwed me on a pot deal back in college. His name went on the list. And then I thought about two more of his buddies that screwed me. Their names went on the list. You know, and when I brought that list in, he just started marking stuff out. And that inventory never got finished anyway, because I was too busy still doing the deal. But step 5, admit it to our God, to ourselves, and to another human being, the exact natures of our own. Folks, that sounds like a really rough step, but it's really not. You know, and if your sponsor has a sense of humor, when you sit down to do this deal, he'll say the sponsor's prayer before you start. And if you haven't ever heard the sponsor's prayer, it's, God, let me hear something different this time. You know? They've heard it all, you know? I think we could all do an inventory and throw it in the basket and grab it out, and with the exception of names and places, we could do a fifth step from somebody else's fourth step. I don't, you know, we're all alike. We're just alcoholics. We have the same feelings and thoughts and actions, and you know. 6 and 7, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character and humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. I don't know that I've ever been entirely ready, but I've been willing. And a couple of character defects I've been able to, for the most part, turn into assets. One of them is greed. And the reason I say that is because there are a ton of good things this program has to offer that I still haven't gotten yet. A lot of promises in the big book, not just those 12 we read. I want everything this program has to offer, because everything I've gotten so far has been so much more than I ever knew existed or that I could even have. You know, that's why at almost 17 years, I'm still just as active, probably more now than I was when I got here. The amend steps, you know, made a list of all persons we had harmed, became willing to make amends to them all. Making the list was okay. Wasn't a problem making the list, because I've heard people that after they do their fourth and fifth step, their sponsor tells them to burn it. And I think, well, what do they do when they get to that step that says, referring to our list that we've just burned? So, you know, we had the basis for the list, and we had a few more people on there, but became willing. There were two people I was not willing to make amends to. It was my ex-boss, who had fired me just because I stole a bunch of money and filed felony theft charges on me. And the district judge, who I knew was in collusion with my ex-boss, went up for my arraignment, and the judge, Judge Morgan, says, where's your lawyer? Well, I can't afford one. Not a word. He says, you're going to have a lawyer. I said, well, you're going to have to appoint me one. He said, well, I'll appoint you one, but my rule is, if I appoint you a lawyer, you're going to stay in jail till your trial comes up. oh, I can't do that. You know, I got to find a job and support my family. And you know, all of a sudden, I'm responsible. He says, you'd be back here in a month. You'd be here with a lawyer. So I went back in a month. Didn't have a lawyer. Where's your lawyer? Told you last month, can't afford one. He said, I told you last month, you better get you one. I said, if you want me to have a lawyer, you're going to have to appoint me one, but I ain't going to jail. I'll just represent myself. He says, you be back here in a month with a lawyer, or else you will go to jail. Now, folks, I don't recommend this behavior if you if you've got an indictment against you. And what I did not know, Judge Morgan had two or three friends in, that were in the program that had been trying to work with me, that were begging him to be patient with me. Otherwise, he'd have thrown my butt in jail that first day. He wouldn't have cared. So I finally asked my mom for some money for a lawyer and ended up getting 5 years adjudicated probation. Thanks to AA, was able to complete that without a problem. Telling some guys that suffered a night, I'd never been able to do probation ever without screwing it up. And I was scared to death. How am I going to do 5 years? And this old fart says, well, what did you agree to the judge that you were going to do? I said, well, I got to pay this amount of fine and restitution and monthly probation fees and your analysis and 200 hours community service and blah, 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 blah. He goes, okay, here's your plan. Do that. Oh, it never occurred to me before, you know. Just do what I agreed to do. And when I did that, after about 2 years, a probation officer said, you know, I really don't need to see you every month. Let's just make it every couple of months. And after about the third year, he goes, I hate for you to keep driving over here every couple of months. Let's just make it 3 months. They don't do that in Bosque County, guys. They do not do that in Bosque County. But for some reason, they were doing it for me. And I was sitting at work one day, and it dawned on me I had forgotten to report. You know, it's pretty easy when you get into a routine. The second Wednesday of every month you go over, but you know, every 3 months you kind of lose track. And I pulled the little card out of my desk and I looked, and I hadn't just missed it a couple of days; I'd missed it by over a month. So I told my boss, I said, I got to go Meridian like right now, and if I'm not back in an hour and a half, get some bail money together, because they probably got a warrant out for me for not reporting. I get over there, I run up the stairs and go into his office, and he's sitting there at his desk, and he says, what do you want? I said, I forgot to report. He had them little half glasses. I hate people with those half glasses at work. Look at you, you know. He says, sit down. He's in one of them chairs with the wheels, and he wheels over to the filing cabinet and whips it open and pulls my file out and wheels over to the desk, throws it down. He's looking over there and looking at me and looking at that and looking at me. He goes, yeah, you should have been here almost a month ago. Anything wrong? Well, no, I just forgot. You forgot? I go, yeah, you got me coming every 3 months. It's just not a habit anymore. He said, have you been drinking? No. Still going to meetings? No. Up, comes down, writes a little deal, hands me a card, says, see you in 3 months. That was the closest I came in 5 years to screwing my probation up. When we got to my boss, I don't know how I got that off track, but when we got to my boss and Judge Morgan, I said, no, I'm not willing to make amends because they just did me wrong, period. My sponsor goes, well, would you be willing to be willing? I go, no, I'm not going to be willing to make amends to those guys. He said, would you be willing to be willing to be willing to make amends to those guys? I go, yeah, whatever, okay, sure, let's move on, you know. Well, a year or so later, I'm covering a Meet the Candidates night in the Civic Center at Clifton. And Judge Morgan's one of the candidates. And he's standing up there giving his little speech, and I'm writing notes. And he said he saw an average, I think he said an average of 1,100 cases a year in three counties. And he'd been sitting on the bench for over 12 years. Folks, that's like 14,000 cases. And it hit me. Out of 14,000 cases, I thought he was out to get me. And I happened to be sitting with a couple of people in AA at this Meet the Candidates night, even though I was working. And I just kind of looked at them, and I looked up at Judge Morgan, and I bowed my head, and I said a little prayer, and I said, God, if this is the wherever in making this amends, give me some kind of sign. Judge Morgan finished, and he sat down a few rows from me, and he kind of turned around and looked around, and he looked at me and caught my eye and winked. And when it was all over, all the politicians went to different spots in the Civic Center to stand there and meet people and greet them, you know. And I look over, and there's not a soul standing in front of Mr. Judge Morgan. And I poked the guy next to me. I said, Josh, I got to go make amends to this guy. What? I got to go make amends to this guy. So I got up and went over to Judge Morgan, and I made amends for my actions in his court. Told him I regretted the way I acted, that it was wrong. And I told him how much I appreciated him putting me on probation because I'd been sober for a year or two and was turning my life around. And he was grateful that I came over and did that. He said, I've never really had anybody tell me that before. Josh just freaked out. And he gathered up everybody else in the program that was in the Civic Center. Y'all's out of here. What David just did. He goes, why'd you do that? I said, because that's what you taught me to do. The other one was my ex-boss, and I finally got to where I was willing, but he wasn't willing to accept my phone calls. I wanted to call over and make an appointment to come see him. He actually had his office in McGregor. So after several failed tries, and I went over there one day, and his pickup was there, and his office was lit up, but he wasn't there. There were instructions that if I showed up, he did not want to talk to me. So I talked to Max and wrote him a letter. Told him in this letter what I wanted to tell him. And mailed it. Never knew if he ever got it. About 5 years ago, I walked into a meeting at Gatesville. I used to make a lot of meetings in Gatesville. Walked in about 7:30. And there he sat. And he saw me and his eyes got huge. And he stood up and he came over and shook my hand. And I said, John, there's some stuff we really need to talk about. And we went in the back, and I said, did you ever get a letter from me? He says, not that I know of. And I said, John, I got a bunch of amends I know through the court. I did the financial stuff. I said, but there's some stuff that I need to tell you. He goes, no. He says, I understand everything now. He goes, I'm an alcoholic. And he was in recovery. And I said, I still want to get together. We'll get together sometime. We'll have lunch and talk and visit. And I never saw him again until I got word that about 3 years after that, he died from cancer. Died sober. Yeah. Those two amends that I wasn't willing to make, I'm glad I was able to make them. You know, I don't know how much of a difference it made in their life, but it made a big difference in mine. Running out of time, but continue to take personal inventory, and when we're wrong, promptly admitted it. I do that normally at night just before I go to sleep. My wife doesn't understand how I go to sleep so fast. It's because y'all have taught me, for the most part, not to do the things that I have to review and decide I need to make amends for. And usually long before I finish reviewing my day, God's going, you're all right, you're gone, and I'm out. Sought through in prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. It's about 6 months sober, and an old Al-Anon named Fred and I were talking after a meeting, and I don't remember what big problem I had. I said, but I keep using the Serenity Prayer and it just didn't help him. He goes, well, let me give you this prayer I use. Okay. He says, it's God grant me the knowledge of your wisdom for me and the power to carry that out. And I wrote it down. I thought, man, this guy is a spiritual giant. That's the neatest prayer I've ever heard in my life. And I started using it over and over and over. And I was probably 6 more months before I was sitting in our home group and I was looking at the same kind of banners on the wall and I went,
That's the damn 11th step.
He just reworded it. But you know, he is still a spiritual giant, because that prayer still works in my life. And I give it to my sponsees, and I give it to my friends, and I haven't seen Fred in years. I don't know how he's doing. I know he got really ill, but whether he's alive or not, that prayer of his is still alive. Everybody that's come and gone in the program before me that have passed away sober, they're not really gone. And it's the same way with Bob. He'll never be gone. He'll be in our heads. You can't shake him. When you're about to do something stupid, one of their voices is going to pop into your head. Especially the one I have that's right before I do something stupid. He always says, the first thing that pops into your head, don't do it, because it's wrong. If you're an alcoholic, it's going to be wrong. Somebody cuts you off on the highway or jumps in front of you at the grocery store, the first thought that pops into your head, don't do it, because it's going to be wrong, and you're going to have to make amends. And I don't like doing that. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these tests, they told me it doesn't say a result or one of the results. It says the result of these steps. We tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice this principle in all our affairs. When I first was getting sober, whenever I went to a meeting, there were always three or four other big drunks in the car. And I went up to this old timer and I said, look at me, man, I'm carrying the message. He said, no, you're not. You're just carrying drunks to the message. You don't even know what the message is yet. And that hacked me off until I realized he was right. I didn't have a clue. If I'm going to carry the message, I've got to know what the message is. And what is the message? It's different to everybody in the program. But my part of the message is, I don't have to drink. And y'all have shown me a new way of life that I never knew I could live. Really good friend of mine, some of y'all may know him, Jerry, I'm going to break it down maybe, he won't care, Jerry Cook always says, if it's not mine, don't take it, if it's not right, don't say it, if it ain't proper, don't do it. That's kind of the way I try to live my life today. The golden rule, whatever you want to call it. The back of the big book, there's a passage that says, doing the things you ought to do because you want to do it. That's who I am today. Real quick, I know I need to wrap up. When I first started getting sober, one of the things that I could not do that I did all my life was listen to rock music. I'm passionate for rock music. Always have been. But it was too good a trigger. It didn't matter what station I listened to, what cassette I put in, it drove me nuts. So I tried listening to jazz, and it's okay. And I tried Christian rock, and it's okay. And talk radio, got hooked on that for a while. And one Christmas, my wife and I and two kids in the back were going to Waco, and I think it was Dream On by Aerosmith came on. And, of course, I don't have much of a voice, but that doesn't stop me from singing. And I'm singing this song, and I look over, and my wife's sitting next to me, and she's singing. And I look up in the rearview mirror, and our kids must have been maybe 12 and 8, 12 and 9, and they're singing. And I just started crying. I don't know that they knew I was crying, but I knew it was okay. I not only had the family that I loved, that we had a bond now, that they weren't scared of me. They were okay being around me. And rock music. The odd thing is, I began to see how many rock musicians are getting sober too. And there's a song by Aerosmith that they wrote that I had loved the song when it came out. I had no idea it was about sobriety. But I like to read the words when I speak because it kind of sums up my journey through sobriety. The song is called Amazing. They wrote, I kept the right ones out and let the wrong ones in. I had an angel of mercy to see me through all my sins. There were times in my life when I was going insane, trying to walk through the pain. But I lost my grip. I hit the floor. I thought I could leave, but I couldn't get out the door. I was so sick and tired of living a lie, I was wishing that I would die. It's amazing, with a blink of an eye, you finally see the light. It's amazing when the moment arrives that you know you'll be all right. It's amazing, and I'm saying a prayer for the desperate hearts tonight. That one last shot is a permanent vacation, and how high can you fly with broken wings? Life's a journey, not a destination, and I just can't tell what tomorrow brings. It's amazing, with a blink of an eye, you finally see the light. It's amazing when the moment arrives that you know you'll be all right. It's amazing, and I'm saying a prayer for the desperate hearts tonight. When I came out of that sober blackout, in a blink of an eye, I knew who I was, and I knew what I had to do. And I knew if I did those things that I would be all right. We've walked through a lot of pain in sobriety, a lot of problems, a lot of trouble, but we walked through them. And I've become a better person for it. I have y'all to thank for that. A lot of y'all I've never met, but I still have y'all to thank for that. I have everybody that's ever walked into an AA meeting. You're my family. You're part of my sobriety and one of the reasons I keep coming back. Thank y'all for inviting me to be here. I don't know what I said, but I know I'm done.
Thanks. Thank you, David. Thank y'all for allowing me to chair this meeting tonight. If you're a newcomer in need of a sponsor, please refer to the sponsor board. Is there anyone here that would like the desire tip at this time to try our way of life, sobriety, for the next 24 hours? Okay. Please remember we are self-supporting for our own contributions. We'll pass the basket now. And if you have any papers that need signed, just place them in the basket and I'll sign them after the meeting. Announcements are on the board. I guess the most major announcement, the hardest one to announce, is Bob's funeral tomorrow at 4. Is there anyone else that would like to share any other AA-related announcements? Okay, as chairperson, I am responsible to see that this room is clean and in order. Please clean up after yourselves. And anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions. Where we are now, where we are going, please respect this and treat it in confidence. Whom you see and what you hear here. We will now close with the Lord's Prayer. David, would you take us out, please?
Which one?
David Anderson. David Anderson, would you please take us out? Go for it.
Who needs us over?
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Let thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Keep your prayer back to the earth and the earth.